You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
A Baltimore Story. That's the title of today's talk. I found the story of Marin Alsop so inspiring. She's just coming to the end of 14 years with that orchestra. Now, Baltimore might not be the place you'd expect to find a prominent orchestra. It's infamous for crime, outranking both Chicago and LA. Before the Civil War, it was home to many freed slaves, and today more than 60% of its population are black. In September last year, riots broke out after Freddie Gray's funeral. He was a young man who was arrested for carrying a knife, which incidentally isn't a crime in the US. He was thrown into a paddy wagon in leg irons and no seat belt and subjected to what police call a rough ride. Three vertebrae were crushed and his spinal cord was three quarters severed at the neck. Public transport was stopped on the day of his funeral. High school students were trapped in the streets. All hell broke loose and riots raged over the ensuing days. Major sporting fixtures were cancelled, schools closed, but the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra reacted differently and provided a free concert. Here's a little piece from the Baltimore Sun. One by one, people rose to their feet and placed their hands over their hearts as musicians for the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra began to play the first strains of the Star Spangled Banner. The audience of nearly 1,000 people began to sing along at the free outdoor concert for peace. At first, their voices were soft. Gradually, the volume grew louder until the refrain rang out, "O'er the land of the free," the crowd sang, "and the home of the brave." It was an emotional moment that expressed the love that both musicians and their listeners feel for their nation, and by extension for the city in which the symphony is located. "We will always be here for you," the orchestra's music director, Marin Alsop, told the crowd that gathered outside the Meyerhoff Symphony Hall. Now, Marin's story did not begin in Baltimore. It was New York. She was the child of professional musicians, and she began playing piano at 2. By 6, it was obvious it wasn't working. "How would you like to go to summer camp?" her parents asked. Well, what American child would say no to summer camp? It has a mystique about it. Except this summer camp was more like a musical boot camp, practicing from 8 a.m. in the morning to 1 p.m. each day on the violin. Effective, though. By the age of 7, Marin was ensconced in the pre-college Juilliard School Orchestra. She was in heaven. She loved the sound of the orchestra all around her. By the time she was 9, a few complaints about her emerged. She liked to move and have fun. This was perceived as trying to lead the orchestra from the back row of the second violins. Her father took her to a young people's concert. She fell in love with the conductor who was jumping around on the podium having a whale of a time and not being yelled at. "That's what I want to be," she told her father, and never wavered. It was Leonard Bernstein in a turtleneck talking directly to her. Well, to the audience, actually. She told her violin teacher her ambition and was rebuffed. "You're too young," she said. "Besides, girls don't do that." Now, one of these objections would resolve itself. The other one was bound to be problematic indefinitely. Distressing. Marin's understanding of gender issues before this was straightforward enough. Dad played the violin, Mum played the bigger instrument, the cello, and Dad got to carry it. Well, her mother went ballistic, threatening to sue the school, and her father arranged a present for the breakfast table the next day. It was a box full of batons. She completed a BA and an MA in violin at the Juilliard, but the next step of the way, getting accepted into conducting school, was strewn with road bumps. Your academics aren't strong enough. Counter-argument, it's a Juilliard MA. Okay, but you need to be able to play this. This was a piano transcription of a Mahler symphony. Bit tricky for a violinist who had abandoned the piano as a six-year-old. Now, you can practice a violin, you can carry it wherever you like, but if your instrument is an orchestra, how do you practice? Marin's answer was to gather friends. First came a string band called String Fever, playing everything from jazz to classical. After playing at a Mr. Taki's wedding, she told him the only thing she ever wanted to do was to conduct. He became her non-musical mentor, and he funded the orchestra she started, the Concordia Orchestra, which played everything, but it specialized in modern American music, both jazz and classical. Now, all this practice paid off, and her fifth attempt to join the conducting school at Tanglewood was successful. Bernstein became her mentor. Some rather lovely photos of the two of them have been commented upon by well-meaning supporters of #MeToo. They would seem to be aware of the gender identity and preference status of either subject. Alsop herself described Bernstein as a big Labrador puppy. Film footage of the two of them shows a high degree of comfort in close proximity. Alsop credits Bernstein with setting her free to be herself on the podium. After observing her at a workshop, he commented, "You're doing everything right, but it just doesn't touch me." She was devastated, but she bounced back and really let rip on her next turn on the podium. He didn't wait for the end, but applauded and said, "That's it, that's it," in the middle of her performance, and she never looked back. As her international career took off, Tommy Otaki, who had supported her for 18 years, asked, "But what about the other women?" Marin's attitude has been that it was tough for her, so she wants to make the road easier and more rewarding for the next wave of women conductors. This impelled her to start the Taki Conducting Concordia Fellowship in 2002 to give women a chance to make mistakes and learn in a safe environment. Now, to sit in the middle of an orchestra facing Ms. Alsop as she conducts is not to watch a woman or a figure of controversy, but to see and hear simply a confident conductor who radiates authority. Her cues are continual and precise, signaled by the circle of a thumb and forefinger in her left hand and a quick widening of her creased eyes. Her baton arm beats very precisely and clearly, and she dispenses brisk compliments and one-liners. It's off stage that the labels begin. Pioneer, that's all the firsts. Protégé, great communicator. They would appear to be unaware of the gender identity and preference status of either subject. Alsop described Bernstein as a big Labrador puppy. Film footage of the two of them shows a high degree of comfort in close proximity. Alsop credits Bernstein with setting her free to be herself on the podium. After observing her at a workshop, he commented, "You're doing everything right, but it just doesn't touch me." She was devastated, but bounced back and really let rip on her next turn on the podium. He didn't wait for the end, but applauded and said, that's it," in the middle of her performance, and she has never looked back. As her international career took off, Tommy Otaki, who had supported her Concordia Orchestra for 18 years, asked, "But what about the other women?" Marin's attitude has been that it was tough for her, so she wants to make the road easier and more rewarding for the next wave of women conductors. This impelled her to start the Taki Conducting Concordia Fellowship in 2002 to give women a chance to make mistakes and learn in a safe environment. Now, to sit in an orchestra facing Ms. Allsop as she conducts is not to see and hear a woman or figure of controversy, but to see and hear simply a confident conductor who radiates authority. Her cues are continual and precise, signalled by the circle of the thumb and forefinger in her left hand and a quick widening of her creased eyes. Her baton arm beats very precisely, very clearly, and she dispenses brisk compliments and one-liners. It's off stage that the labels begin: pioneer, protege, great communicator, master speaker from the stage and charming with donors, and most recently, genius. Modern composers love her. She loves Mahler and Brahms also. Audiences love her, but some musicians can be ornery. Colorado was a steep learning curve, a bigger orchestra. She was accused of favoritism because of her committed relationship with the horn player Kirsten Yorkscheid. This accusation didn't linger because it didn't have legs. Then the brass section, the big guys in the orchestra, set up a ping pong table. She didn't like it. They argued it helped resolve personal differences. She gave in and even participated in a tournament. She learned not to wade straight into correction, but to give credit where it was due before moving on to areas needing improvement. When her appointment to the BSO was announced, the musicians objected vociferously. They felt left out of the selection process. They accused her of being dull, lightweight, uninspiring. She felt like backing off and was advised to, but figured, being the first woman to be appointed to a major orchestra, it would be a very bad look. She held a closed-door meeting with them with no management present. She argued they didn't know her. She had previously been engaged by the BSO to conduct some non-serious music. She talked directly to the audience. Now, this was probably the source of reservations about her musicianship. She outlined her vision, praised their musicianship, agreement was reached, and the first concert, which was a triumph, included Mahler's Fifth and a contemporary composer, John Adams. Definitely not non-serious. Soon after, the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra was offered recording contracts. Now, this hadn't happened for more than a decade. 60% of capacity concerts gave way to sold-out performances. Rusty's programs involved inviting members of the general public to play with the orchestra in special sessions. 600 people applied the first time. She took them on 60 at a time, and subscriptions went through the roof. Friendships and community support followed. More difficult was the Orchids program. Despite the fact blacks outnumbered whites in Baltimore, the orchestra had only one black player in 2007. Lack of opportunity, inequality, social disadvantage, economic disadvantage. It took a full year to persuade the orchestra to assist with mentoring. They started with an after-school program for 30 kids. Now, 1,500 a year enter the program. The first few are starting to get jobs in orchestras now. In 2012, she took on the chief conductor role at OSESBI, a year later, artistic director also. Sao Paulo to Baltimore was a big commute and lasted 7 years as her contract was extended in both locations. Like Baltimore, Sao Paulo is a city of contrasts, high crime and high culture. The concert house is in a refurbished railway station right in the middle of Sao Paulo's crackland. In 2012, Sao Paulo wanted Marin because she was personable, would get on with soloists, which the previous conductor had not, was committed to education. Marin set up an Orchids program there that now educates 30,000 kids a year, and there are 120,000 kids a year who attend the concerts there. She is now honorary conductor of Sao Paulo. When she leaves Baltimore, she'll keep up support for Orchids. Her new big job will be with the Radio Symphony in Vienna. The Vienna Radio Symphony Orchestra only started employing women instrumentalists in 1997. It's more conservative than the Berlin Philharmonia, which left it to 1982 to start employing women. A reporter from The Guardian wrote after the announcement of her appointment, "Vienna has an occasionally stultifying musical environment that values quality over curiosity and status over quality. the Vienna RSO has been a much welcome platform for music just off the very well beaten path. Now, she'll be the first woman to take up that prestigious role. Marin herself is over being first. First to conduct the last night of the proms in 2013. First to lead the Ravinia Festival. First at Bournemouth, but Baltimore. It's pathetic, she said, to be still notching up firsts in the 21st century. She's not the first to complain. Mid-20th century Nadia Boulanger, teacher of Aaron Copland and a host of other composers and first echelon musicians, eventually put a reporter in his place when he asked, "How does it feel to be the first woman to..." "I've been a woman for a little over 50 years now, and after my initial astonishment, I've gotten over it." Indeed, the same week as Allsop's last night at the proms performance, another well-known conductor, and a young one, Vasily Petrenko, said, "A cute girl on the podium means the musicians think about other things." He emailed Marin up and claimed to have been quoted out of context. She rang and invited him to mentor some students at the Taki Concordia. He didn't, in other words, get away with it. Of the 500 or so orchestras in the States, only 6.5% are led by women. Of the 15 full-time best budgeted orchestras, only the BSO has a woman at the helm, and she's moving on very soon. In the UK, the percentage is less. It's 5.5%. Shocked by the daft response to the 2013 proms, Alice Farnham set up a conducting program for women. The appointment of young Lithuanian Mirga Grishinti-Tila to the top position at City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra last year may be a sign of an encouraging trend in normalising the position of women in conducting roles. There is no skill shortage. There is a shortage of willing employers, willing music boards and managers. The problem is ultimately systemic. Doesn't make it excusable. James Murphy, the managing director of Southbank Sinfonia, presented a brief video on the issue for the Association of British Orchestras, which incidentally has offered only 4 of over 100 titled conducting positions to women across 61 orchestras. Now, how does that look to young women emerging from their education and wanting to launch into a career? We want a society in which we don't have to think or talk anymore in terms of male or female conductors, argues Murphy, but it won't magically happen. Nobody else is going to do it for us. He's careful to say in his video that he too has struggled with implicit bias. So there you have it. A male managing director has to tell the British classical music industry that hiring women would be good business practice and that it is largely important to keep up with the times. Sexism in society is so common it seems normal. Other industries are almost as bad as Western classical music. Allsop explains, "Society interprets women's gestures very differently. So if women are exuding an aura of extreme confidence, that can be deemed to be off-putting, whereas it's desirous for men. Despite this, women conductors are often loved by the public and perform to sold-out houses. When the careers of Laurence Ekelbey and Nathalie Stutzmann took off in France, the sales of 18th century music, chamber, choral, contralto, went up sharply. Audiences were not the problem. Conductors like Simon Rattle and Owasa Seji mentored people like Nathalie Stutzmann, but they are exceptional. So are the non-Anglo countries that led the way, Japan, the Scandinavian nations, and Brazil. Famous Latvian-born conductor Maris Jansons declared in an interview with The Telegraph recently that he couldn't get used to the sight of a woman conducting an orchestra. He told the newspapers that he wasn't against the idea. "It's a question of what one's used to. I grew up in a different world, and for me, seeing a woman on the podium, well, it's not, shall I say, it's not my cup of tea." Yuri Temirkanov, Marin's predecessor at Baltimore and the Emeritus Artistic Director, said he just didn't like women conducting. "It's like fish," he said. "I don't like fish." He sat in Marin's dressing room while a Baltimore Sun reporter recorded these remarks. Now, in most industries, attacks on women must be coded. These remarks are not encoded. The classical world is dragging the chain. So where does that leave us? Progress has been made in hiring musicians. Many US orchestras use a process to conceal gender identity of applicants auditioning. A screen separates auditioning panel and applicants, and carpet on the floor eliminates the sound of footsteps, which could reveal gender. Managers like James Murphy managed to set up festivals with equal numbers of talented male and female conductors without sacrificing quality. How does he know who they are? Well, they're often lauded guests of the best orchestras in the world. The very few, the 5% who have their own artistic director's post or chief conductor are truly remarkable. Often they were born into families in which both parents had professional music careers. They often form their own orchestras to get a toehold in. Strutzman's Orfeo 55 or Marin's String Fever. My point is, men do not have to be either that talented or that experienced to get their first go in the big league. Some are even invited into management roles as they leave their conservatory or school. And of course, the classical world is just part of the real world. The interesting thing is, how do we feel about women in leadership positions? At work? In the pulpit? Do we judge them differently? What obligations have we to speak if others are criticizing their appearance or their fashion sense? How do we handle the mildly worded, "it's just not my cup of tea" statement or preference? Or, you know how women are expected to be loving and caring and men can get away with a few tactless remarks or lapses in compassion. All things being equal, it'd be less trouble to employ a... ouch. Now, asked for the umpteenth time to respond to a series of outrageous remarks, Marin Alsop said she had some compassion for those who don't think before they open their mouths. We should bear that in mind, after all, judge not. I also think quotas have a place to encourage looking at the talent. I don't like fish either. It's unacceptable in any arena. Besides, fish is good for the brain.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.